Ezra chapter 2. Here in Ezra chapter 2, we find the names of a lot of people, and I'm not going to read them. I can't read very well as it is, and I'd certainly make a blunder of all these names. But as we look at this passage here tonight, if you're a Christian, God has a job for you to do. And there's something for every Christian to do, get involved in, whether it be sweeping the floor or teaching class, and lots of things in between. Sometimes they're jobs of honor, and sometimes they're jobs of insignificance. It doesn't really make any difference. The biggest thing is we need to be willing to do the job for the glory of the Lord. And if you're not a church member, you can join and you can get involved in other ministries that aren't available to other people. But the thing of it is that God has a job for all of us, every one of us, even you young boys. God's got a job for every one of us. There's something we can all do. And last week we learned in Ezra chapter 1 that we learned about the faith-fortifying facts. Facts that Isaiah and Jeremiah made prophecies that were hundreds of years earlier, and that they came to pass exactly. We saw how Cyrus, God had stirred his heart, this pagan king stirred his heart to set the Jews free and to let them go back to their country and rebuild the temple. And God stirred the hearts of the people to go back to Israel. And we're going to be looking at that tonight, of how he stirred their hearts to go back, and all the complications involved in that. And then he also stirred the hearts of Cyrus and the people to give generously toward that project. And they gave sacrificially to be able to meet needs and be able to go back. The second chapter here of Ezra is one of those chapters, there's a great temptation to skip it. But you know, when we get to these kind of passages, you know, I have to admit that pronouncing every word of these hard names, I probably don't pronounce every name when I go through it. But I look for the ones that I can pronounce, and I go through this chapter, and there's a reason. Because you can learn things, and you say, hey, I recognize that guy. I remember where he came from. And you can put the pieces together, and it helps you build your database of information in your mind that will help you to better understand the overall structure of the Bible. But tonight, as we look at this, I want us to notice here that this chapter reveals several different kinds of work or jobs that the people had. And it's a reminder to us that God has a job for all of us. And so as we look at this here tonight, we're going to be seeing the diversity of the people, the diversity of their jobs, and the generous giving of the people. So as we begin here in chapter 2, look at verse number 2. Chapter 2, well, we'll start at verse number 1. Now these are the children of the province that went up out of the captivity of those which had been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away unto Babylon, and came again to Jerusalem and Judah, every one unto his city, which he came with Zerubbabel and all these other guys. All right, so Zerubbabel is the first one mentioned. Zerubbabel was the leader. So the first person we see was Zerubbabel. Now, he was the leader of the people. And In your Bible, you might even make a notation, you know, that Zerubbabel was set aside. And we're going to see in verse 3, it starts talking about the children. But in verse 2, it's talking about Zerubbabel and the other leaders. There were 10 other fellows that were under him that were also leaders. And Zerubbabel, being the leader, his Hebrew name was Zerubbabel. But his Babylonian name, his Persian name, we see in verse number 8 of chapter 1. Flip the page back and look at verse number 8. It says, even those did Cyrus, king of Persia, bring forth by the hand of Merodach, the treasurer, and numbered them unto Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. Now, Sheshbazzar was very likely the Persian name for Zerubbabel. And there's good reasons for believing that. Not everybody agrees. Some people think there are two different people. But most of the Bible dictionaries and most commentators think that Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar were the same guy, just two different names. Now, one of the things that's pretty interesting when you think about this, did everybody that went to Babylon get a Babylonian name or a Persian name? Probably not. But the people who were working for the government did. Because the king's didn't want to call them by their clumsy Hebrew name. They wanted to call them by a Babylonian name. So Daniel was renamed Belteshazzar. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were that was their names in Babylonian. We know them because they're probably easier to name than Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so those were the Hebrew names and the Babylonian names. Now, if this man, Zerubbabel, truly is Sheshbazzar, it would indicate then that he must have had some kind of a governmental position in Babylon. Just like Daniel, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and others who had been renamed. Because the average Job probably wouldn't have gotten a new name when he went to Babylon, because why give him a new name? He's just a nobody. And we don't need to know his name, and we don't need to call his name. But they didn't want to talk, you know, and use the Hebrew names. And so it's very likely that that Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar were the same guy, just the same person, two different names. Now, remember with me, it's good for us to review these numbers in our minds. And I'll take my little paper here so we can get this. Remember the captivity when the people went to Babylon. All right. You can look at the map here, first of all. It'll kind of refresh your memory. You got Israel over here. Babylon's way over here. You couldn't go across the middle because of its desert. So they had to go up and then follow the river down to come down to Babylon. So it was a long, long journey. And when they went over to Babylon, right, when they went over the first time, they went in three different dispersions. In 606 was the first one. The second one was 597. 597, and then 586. Were the three different times they went over. Now, in 586, Jerusalem was destroyed, completely wiped out. The temple was broken to pieces. The place was burnt down. It was completely wiped out. Daniel went in the first one, and Ezekiel may have gone in the second dispersion, and then everybody else. It wasn't just those guys, but those were two of the guys that we would know of. That went, and then everybody else that went captive went in the last one. And the place was destroyed, burnt down, torn to pieces. There was nothing left but rubble. All right, at the end here. All right, now when they came back, God sent them back. It was also in three different times. The first one was 536, and the second one is 458, and the last one was 445. And these dates, I mean, as you look in Bible dictionaries, they may be 1 year off. Not everybody agrees on the exact dates, but they're pretty close to what most of them do. Now, when you think about this, so what that means then is between this last dispersion and the first return is only 50 years. But between 606 and here, there's 70 years. All right? So some of the people, like Daniel, had been over there for 70 years when Cyrus said go back. All right, so the 70 years had been fulfilled. There were some then that could have gone back that were only in had been there 50 years. So if they were 10 years old when they left Israel, they'd be 60 years old, about my age, when the Cyrus said you can go back. So those kind of people would have been knowledgeable. They would have remembered what Israel was like. But a lot of the people didn't know anything about it. They were born over in Babylon and went over. So you've got a large variety of people that we're dealing with there, and the different things that they were, the way they were looking at things as they were going back. Now, Zerubbabel was their leader. He was the supervisor of the building project. When they got back to Jerusalem, the huge task, I mean, huge task of building that temple. It was no little building. It was gigantic. It was a huge building. And building it up, and he was the supervisor of all of that. And so he had a great responsibility. And evidently under him, these other 10 guys that are listed here in verse number 2, there's Jeshua and Nehemiah, and it wouldn't be the same Nehemiah that we know of later on, and Shariah and all these other guys, and the Mordecai. The Mordecai probably wasn't, in fact, I'm pretty sure it wasn't the one that we know about in the book of Esther, just a guy with the same name. And so all these other guys were men who came back that were leaders with him. He was in charge. These were kind of his lieutenants under him, or whatever you want to call them. They were his workers right under him, next in charge with him, that were leading the nation back. And leadership job, you know, a lot of times people think, boy, I wish I could be the leader. Well, leadership has its own perks, and there's no question about that. There's some cool things about being a leader, but being a leader has a tremendous responsibility and accountability. You know, I think even as a pastor, you know, there's a lot of responsibility, and the accountability is the thing that's scary. One day I'm going to stand before God and give an account for everything I've taught you and everything I haven't taught you, how I've responded to things, how I've dealt with things, how I've led, I'm going to have to give an account. So the leaders, there is accountability. And good leaders lead by example. That's a tough one, but that's the truth. Good leaders lead by example. And so to be a good leader, we need to be a good example. And so, men, that's a good thing for us to keep in mind in our families, is we have to be a good example before our families if we're going to be a good leader. So this was Zerubbabel. Second, we see the common people. Verses 2 to 35 deal with the common people. Notice here that there's something they have in common here. As you read down through there, it talks about the children of this guy and the children of this guy and the children of this guy and the children of this guy, all the way down through there. They're all the children of these. Now, so that's talking about this. These are the families of Parash. That's why I'm not going to read these. Names are too hard. So all their families and all their names. So these are the children of these. Now, if you read down through that, the text later on, it tells us that there was 42,360 of these people. 42,360 of them. And it may include the priests. And it probably did. It may include the priests and the Levites. But it didn't include everybody. Some of the other ones were tacked on later, and we'll see that in a moment. And these common people, they had no particular job, but they had volunteered to go back and work and to help rebuild the temple. And so they were just regular people. Some of them may have been carpentry-type oriented or mason-oriented. Others were, you know, maybe chefs or something else that didn't have these jobs. But they said, I'm willing to go. I'll work. You teach me how to do it, I'll do it. And so they were willing to go and to do what they could because they wanted to honor the Lord in this way. That the group would have certainly included male and female, young and old, educated, uneducated. Everybody was involved. And so there's thousands of these people. You know, again, leading a group of 42,000 people back to Jerusalem from Babylon. Long journey across there. In just a moment, we're going to see how long it was. It was a long journey. 1,450 kilometers. 1,450 kilometers from Babylon back to Jerusalem. That's a long hike, especially if you've got 42,000 people. You've got to feed them, you've got to take care of them, you've got to protect them, you know, take care of all the problems, solve the fights and arguments and all the stuff that comes on when you've got that many people all together. The housing, the tents, every day you travel and put up your tents and take down the tents and get up in the morning and blow on the trumpets to get going in the morning. Let's all go. And, you know, there's somebody lagging behind. Come on, get them back there. Don't let them get far behind because they can get lost or they can get hurt. And you know, there's some that want to push on. And oh, come on, slow down now. We've got to wait for everybody else. And all the animals that were with them. Massive responsibility. Just gigantic responsibility. But all these people are going back. And they all have one thing in common. And that is they were willing to sacrifice of themselves to be able to do what God asked them to do. They were willing to do God's work. Even if it was something they didn't know anything how to do, they were willing to serve the Lord in these ways. And they became the builders. They were the ones who were going back to build the temple and to do the work of the Lord in that way. Now, this willingness that they had, it involved being willing to go through the hardships of that trip. I mean, if we were taken off on a walk for almost 1,500 kilometers, and we're going to walk. Just the thought of taking a walk that long is a gigantic step. It would have taken them months, and it would have been many hardships, crossing the rivers, going through the deserty areas, going, you know, dealing with the wild beasts and the animals, standing guard at night to protect themselves from the animals that may be roving in the area, or the bandits that may be coming to try to rob them. There was a lot of bandits and stuff that would hide along the roads to try to steal from the people that were traveling that long trail. There's all kinds of things. The hardships would have been phenomenal. And then once they get to Israel, what are they going to get once they got back there? Nothing but a broken down, destroyed country that had been laid desolate for at least 50 years. And everything was broken into rubble. And they had to go back. And they went back and they went to their own family's allotments all over Israel. All right? It wasn't just that they went to Jerusalem. Now, I'm not sure how they all worked that, but you read the text, and it talked, even in verse number 1, it talked about all of them went back unto their own city. So they went back to their various cities throughout Israel, reestablished their homes, and they probably, you know, Zerubbabel again would have had things organized so that he was saying, all right, now, you know, on such and such a day, we're all going to come to Jerusalem. You're going to travel down to Jerusalem. We're going to work on the temple. And maybe they had shifts. Maybe there was 10,000 of them that worked at a time. And, you know, I don't know how he did it, but he did something. They were working, but they were still at the same time. They're rebuilding their homes. They went back to, there's nothing but rubble. They'd have to just look, dig through the rubble to try to find stuff, to try to build some kind of a house or a shack to live in for a while until they can get something more permanent made. It was a hardship. This was not an easy thing. It wasn't going back to some fancy little house and sit down in a nice lounge and be able to enjoy life. It wasn't that way at all. It was difficult, very difficult. And it was a sacrifice. And they had no special training. They had no special experience. But they had willing hearts to serve the Lord. And you know, that's really a key that we can learn from in the jobs that God gives us. You know, there are some jobs that really need some specialty. Most jobs, anybody can do if they put their heart into it. And so we need to ask the Lord to guide us and give us wisdom in what we should do for the Lord. Second group of people we see here is the priests, verse 36 to 39. And if your Bible has the paragraph markers in it, you will see that. Some Bibles have divisions in it that help you to see that. But 36 to 39 were the priests. And remember, the priests came from the tribe of Levi. All right? So the priests came from the tribe of Levi, from the family of Aaron. All right? And these were the priests that were involved in the overseeing the spiritual activities of Israel. They dealt with all the priesthood responsibilities and the sacrifices and all the things that were involved in the sacrificial system of the Old Testament. And so this was a priest. And the number of them, the scriptures tell us there, was 4,289. Now, that probably included their families. I would assume it did. It's talking about all of them. It wasn't just men that went back. So it probably would have included their families. But that's still a lot of people that were involved in the priests. Especially when we see, next we'll see the Levites were just a handful of them. And that's we'll talk about that in a moment. But here, the priests are going back, and they had the responsibility of helping the people spiritually. And later on, we're going to see that Ezra came back after they had the temple already built. Ezra came in the next group back to try to help the people establish genuine understanding of their religion and their faith in God. Because even though the priests were there, it was like they were pretty ignorant. Because for at least 50 years, those priests had not done the normal things that the priests did. They had no temple. They had no place to sacrifice. I don't know what the Babylonians allowed them to do. Whether the Babylonians allowed them to have any kind of religious services or whether they said, no way. I don't know. So, but we do know that for at least 50 years, things were severely disrupted. And these priests, by this time, would have been fairly ignorant of what they were really supposed to do. And Ezra came back to teach them and teach the people. And so we'll see that toward the end of the book. But this was the Levites. Now, today, in a local church, God has ordained the pastors to be the spiritual leader of the congregation. So there's a parallel there. Then we see the next is the Levites, verse 40 to 42. 40 to 42 are the Levites. Now, with the Levites are actually broken into three different sections. We'll see that in just a moment. But the Levites, remember, were the servants of the priests. All right, the Levites served the priests. They helped the priests in all of the manual work of caring for the tabernacle, the maintenance, and all that kind of stuff. And he breaks them into three groups here. The first one was the ordinary Levites, and they were the ones that would do all those kind of jobs right there in the tabernacle, the temple, caring for those things that the priests needed help with. Then there were the singers. All right, the singers were in charge of the music. There was a lot of, they sang music in part of their worship, and so the Levites, part of the Levites, were the singers. And then part of the Levites were the children of the porters. Now, the porter refers to a doorkeeper or a gatekeeper. So these were the doorkeepers or gatekeepers. They were keeping charge of the gates. Now, what they did, I'm not sure. Whether they counted people who went in and out, or whether they opened the door for everybody, I don't really know what they did, but they're doorkeepers. And there was a bunch of them, so maybe they probably had shifts and took different. Maybe they were guarding the temple. I really don't know what the doorkeepers did, but keeping the doors of some sort, guarding the temple and watching over that. And you can read in Psalm 84:10, a very interesting verse. Psalm 84:10, the psalmist said, "I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness." To be a doorkeeper in the house of the Lord, he said, it's a menial job. Nothing special about this. What's your job? Well, I stand by the gate, watch the people come in and out, make sure there's no disruptions, don't let anybody in that's not supposed to get in. I'm a doorkeeper. Not a real fancy job. It's kind of like a security guard at Kohl's or something, you know. It's a job. Nothing fancy about it. Pays the bills. But this was one of the Levite groups were the porters, or the children of the porters. Okay? So you got the three groups of the Levites. The next we find in verse 43 to 54 were the Nethinims. All right, 43 to 54, the Nethinims. Now, who were the Nethinims? Well, the Nethinims, you'll remember these, the Nethinims started way back in the days of Joshua. Now, I'm not sure they got their name in the days of Joshua, but the Nethinims were the Gibeonites. Who were the Gibeonites? Remember the Gibeonites? The Gibeonites were the ones that deceived Joshua into thinking that they were from a faraway land and he let them live. They were Canaanites from Gibeah that deceived Joshua and he let them live. So the Nethinims were Gibeonites and other Canaanites that had surrendered to Israel. And they became slaves of the temple. They were temple slaves. And by temple slaves, they were to gather the wood and carry the water. So someone had to go out and collect wood for all the sacrificial burnings. Someone had to get water for all the washing of the animals and the washing of the parts and carry out the old water and carry out the rubbish. That was the Nethinim's job. All right? Not a very nice job, so they gave it to the foreigners that were their slaves. And rather than die, they said, yeah, we'll do that. Don't kill us. We'll be your temple slaves. All right? And so these were the Nethinim's. Next group we see here, and the Nethinims, there were 35 different families, but they're not numbered here. They're actually numbered along with the next group, which is called the Children of Solomon's Servants. Now, the Children of Solomon's Servants, verses 55 through 58, were very likely a lower class than the Nethinims. They seem to be the next step down from the Nethinims. They also were non-Jews. All right, so the Nethinims and the Children of Solomon's Servants were not Jews. They were foreigners that had merged in with the Jews. All right, but they were not Jewish in their origin. And they were probably those that Solomon mentions in 1 Kings 5:13 to 15 that were the stone cutters and timber cutters. They were the hard manual slaves. Again, they were people that Israel had conquered. People who had surrendered to Israel, maybe slaves that they had taken in battle or something of that nature, but they were Solomon's servants. Solomon made them do all the hard work of cutting the stones, cutting the timber, doing all the hard work, the hard manual work. And so these were the children of Solomon's servants. Now, when it says the children of Solomon's servants, years and years had gone by since Solomon's days. All right? Solomon was the third king of Israel, and they'd had many kings since then. But apparently, those people that were slaves under Solomon remained slaves, and these were the children of children of children of children, generation to generation down the road. But they're still slaves, and they're still the children of Solomon's servants. They're still working like the Nethinims to help with the temple and help with all the dirty work and all the hard work and all the hard labor. And whether or not the Nethinims and the children of Solomon's servants were still in a slavery type of a situation, or whether they had actually merged in with the Jews to the point where they were happy to be part of them, I can't say. Whether they went back voluntarily or whether they went back because the Jews told them they were going to go back with them, I don't know that either. But they were with them. And that's who they were. And so the total number of the Nethinims and Children of Solomon's Servants was 392. 392 of them. And the text describes that. Then we come to a smaller group. Verses 59 and 60. This was a group of unsure Jews. People that weren't sure. They couldn't prove that they were really Jews. Verse 59 says, "And these were they which went up from this all these places here, but they could not show their father's house and their seed, whether they were of Israel. All right, so these were people that said, I know I'm a Jew. My daddy was a Jew. I know he was. Well, what was his name? What was his ancestor? Well, I can't remember all that. We've lost all those records. I'm not sure. I can't prove it, but I know we're somehow related to this guy and we're somehow related to this guy. And so they were convinced they were Jews, but they couldn't prove it. All right? So they were put in a category by themselves, but they also would have been numbered among the builders. And their number was 652 of them. So there's 652 of these people that really believed they were Jews, but they couldn't prove it. Then verse 61 to 63 is the same situation with the priests. There were some unsure priests. They said, we are just absolutely confident that we are part of the priesthood. We are relatives of these guys, but we can't find any records to prove it. You know, sometimes we think of all these genealogies in the Bible and think, what a bore, reading through all the Chronicles. Oh, they're related to this. Why do I have to? Well, this is why. They needed to know why. They needed to be able to go back through there and say, look, I'm the son of this guy and the son of this one and the son of this one all the way back. Yep, so look at there. See, I am related to them. They needed those records. They were important to them for the priesthood, for the regular people. It was very important. But we look at them as boring, long lists of names, but they were very significant and they had a very important purpose. That is why they're included in the Bible. So here's priests that couldn't prove what they were, and he says that they couldn't take part in the priesthood activities until they could prove that, and that they would need to wait until they could use the Urim and the Thummim. Verse number 63, they were going to use the Urim and the Thummim to be able to decide whether they were genuine priests or not. Now the Urim and the Thummim, nobody knows exactly what they were, but they were some sort of way of judging. Some people say it might have been a black stone and a white stone. The priest would put it in his little pocket and he'd ask God for wisdom and he'd say, now Lord, if this person is really a priest, then may I pull out the white stone? You know, type of thing. I don't know. It was something of that nature, but God used it miraculously. The Urim and the Thummim. It was something God designed. It wasn't something they made up. If it wasn't exactly that, it might have been something else. Some people, one thing I read was that some believed that it was somehow that God would actually turn, that he had some stones on him, the Urim and the Thummim, that were on the priest's garment somehow, and that God would make one of them light up or brighter. So I don't know. I mean, whatever it was, somehow God was using it to show them his mind so they could have a concrete answer. And they said, you can't partake with the priests until we can prove it. So we've got to use the Urim and Thummim. Now, the last group of people we see here are found in verse number 65. It says that besides their servants and their maids, and of whom there were 7,337, and there were among them 200 singing men and singing women. Now, there's debates over who this is. Probably these were just people's servants. All right? You were just an ordinary person and you had a servant. And he was, may or may not have been a Jew, probably not, but he was your servant or she was your maid. And some of the wealthier families had singing men and singing women that would sing for special events and they were kind of their special chorus. That's what these were. They were servants or slaves that were for these purposes. And there was a group of them that was among them. And so the servants, whether it was just this little group of servants or whether it was all the other Nethinims and all that concluded, I don't think so. It sounds like it was just these, was 7,337. So God had all these different kinds of people that were coming back. And they all had a job. They all had something to do. They all had something they were able to put in and fit in to be a help and a blessing to the ministry of that they were doing. And that is true today. You know, God has a job for every one of us, and they're all important jobs. I may be the pastor, but that doesn't mean that my job is the most important job in our church. It's an important job, but everybody's got a job. And your job of setting up chairs or helping with in the kitchen or doing whatever you do is an important job too. And, you know, if you didn't do your job, we'd have a difficulty. Somebody else would have to do it or else we'd go without it. And we need those things. So we all work together. And so our jobs are important. The most important thing, though, is that we do it for the glory and honor of the Lord. You know, that is the thing that needs to be the most important. Now, as we conclude tonight, we look in verses 69 to 70. that we find the generous giving of the people. Verse 69, and they gave after their abilities unto the treasure of the work of 61,000 drams of gold. All right, now, so the people, 68 actually tells who it was. It was 68, I skipped that. 68 says it was the chief of the fathers that gave. So it was the heads of the households, the fathers, the husbands of the households that were giving. And they gave to the Lord, they gave him, gave to the work of the Lord 1,060 drams of gold. I looked up the drams, and a dram is approximately 318 Aussie dollars. And so that comes to a total of $337,864. A lot of money. $300,000 plus. And that was just the gold. And then they gave silver. And I couldn't figure out exactly how much that was, but there's a lot of silver as well. And they gave priest garments. And so they were giving generously. And it says there that they gave after their ability. Now, when the little phrase there, after their ability, it makes it sound like a little different than it actually was. The word ability literally means their might. It means that they gave with all their might or generously. They put their whole heart into it. They did it because they wanted to. They gave generously with all their desire. And they gave a free will offering. It wasn't forced upon them. They gave it freely. They didn't take, you know, even today, some churches, not too many, I don't think, but there are some, especially among the cults, I know some would actually, you know, keep an eye on how much you're giving, you know, and you're supposed to give this much. And if you don't, come on, you know, knock on your door, how come you haven't given? You're supposed to be given. In olden days, back in England, there were some churches that would rent their pews. And even sometimes in America, they would do this. And if you wanted to sit near the front, it was more expensive than sitting further in the back. And so you had to pay for your row of chairs you sat in or your pews you sat in. So that's how they raised some of the revenues. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us to do that kind of thing. And this was voluntary. They gave of their voluntary to the Lord. And so God wants us to give willingly and generously. And we can't ever outgive the Lord. And that's a good thing to remember. Now, after they gave, they went to their inheritances. Verse number 70, and the priests and the Levites and some of the people and the singers and the porters and the Nethinims dwelt in their cities and all Israel in their cities. So each one had their place they went back to. They were rebuilding their cities, they were rebuilding their homes, they were rebuilding all these things. But at the same time, there was plans going on for rebuilding the temple. Now exactly how all that fit together, I'm not sure. But Zerubbabel was in charge. And more than likely, he had things divided up. I mean, you can't have, you know, well, if you got the women and children in there, if there was 42,000, let's say there was 20,000 men. Well, you can't have 20,000 men working on one building all at the same time. You'd be running into each other. So he probably divided it up into groups and said, all right, we're going to have, you know, 1,000 of you this week and then 1,000 of you next week, and we're going to trade off. We're going to keep, I don't know how he did it, but he did something, and they worked together in rotation, no doubt, and working on building their homes as well as building their own, building the temple. Okay? So, as we see this thing, what I wanted us to focus here on tonight is that God has a job for us. Our little local church here, God has a job for you. There's something you can do. You know, you young people can get involved in helping out as you have, and many of you have been very good about this. You know, you pitch in, you help with the books, help with the chairs, help with the kitchen, you help with putting things up, taking things down, all these things that we do, and all part of our ministry, all part of what we need to do, but it's jobs that you can get involved in. We need to be involved, as we talked this morning, about witnessing and telling people about Christ and inviting people to come. There's things that we all can do, and so there's work for all of us. And so let's get involved. Just ask God, if you don't know what your job is or what you should do, ask the Lord to give you a job. And if you can't find one, come talk to me. I'm sure we can figure out something. So that there's a job that you can do, something you can be involved in the work of the Lord in our ministry here. So this chapter that looked like it was going to be a big bore turns out to be quite an interesting chapter. A very interesting, at least I thought it was. I thought it was great digging through this and learning all these different aspects of it. And it gives me a new light on the whole move back to Jerusalem from Babylon.